Now, along these very same lines, we get the seventh vision here. The angel who talked with me said, the angel who talked with me came out and said, lift your eyes now and see what this is that goes forth. So I asked, what is it? And he said, it is a basket that is going forth. He also said, this is their resemblance throughout the earth. Here is a lead disc lifted up, and this is a woman sitting in the basket. Now let's stop there. All right. So he sees this basket. If you're reading out of the King James or the New American Standard, it actually says ephah for basket. And I believe this is what it is, the term actually literally in the Hebrew. Does anyone know what an ephah was? Yeah, it's a measurement. It was a dry measure. It was the largest dry measure that the Israelites had. I think it here probably is being put for the thing that would contain the ephah. Probably is a basket or something like that, but that is the literal term. Now, as for how big an ephah is, I don't think we really know. I mean, I've got different sources. James Smith says it's 2/3 of a bushel. Homer Haley said 38.86 quarts. It's not real big. But if that's the case, we've got this basket about that size. And what might a basket, an ephah, be a symbol of? God doesn't do things arbitrarily or accidentally. Why might he use an ephah in thinking of the ancient world and how they would use this? All right, it is what they would carry. Yeah.
Before the tabernacle, there was the woman.
Yes.
And now there is the largest mechanism of
the woman. Interesting, interesting. I think you might be, kind of getting to what I was thinking of. Not that what I'm thinking of is right, but in Leviticus 19:36, the law said, you shall have honest scales, honest weights, an honest ephah, and an honest hin. I do wonder if perhaps this ephah here may represent commerce and trade. We know in the days of Amos that business had just become cutthroat and people were just downright dishonest and the poor were being fleeced and couldn't do anything about it. And maybe they were getting back into that sort of thing right now. But whatever the case here is, this basket, notice what he says about it, this basket is going forth. It is not the Lord's intention that this basket should stay in Israel. As we're going to find out, he intends for this basket to go elsewhere. Now, the basket has a lead cover, and lead's pretty heavy. I wonder if that's to keep whatever's in there in there. Yes, Thomas.
What caught my mind was Daniel writing on the wall and he's waiting using lead and
Has
to measure the judgment.
Thanks, I like that. This lead cover is lifted up, and what does Zechariah see sitting in this basket? A woman. Now, I don't know if you're having this experience, but I remember thinking this was just one of the most cryptic visions in the whole Bible. Here's this basket, open, and then here's this woman. I kind of envisioned her crouching in there, but it says she's sitting. And apparently, once the lid's lifted up, what does the woman do? I mean, it's not stated outright, but it does seem to be implied. It looks like she tries to get out because he thrusts her in, says this is wickedness, and slams that cover back down or puts that cover back down. That is the nature of sin. Sin does not like to be confined. Sin wants to get into every part of your life it can. It wants to get into other people's lives. And unless it's confined by the Lord's word and his will, it will spread. Wickedness wants to get out. This is wickedness, thrusts her back down and puts that lid down. I think a woman might be used simply because a woman does have an allure, an attraction about her, and we are attracted to sin. We have to admit that. We are drawn away by our own lusts and enticed. All right. Now, if any woman reading this might feel like we're kind of anti-woman here, we've got some good news in verse 9. I raised my eyes and looked, and there were two women. Two women now. But these women are doing good things. Coming with the wind in their wings, for they had wings like the wings of a stork, and they lifted up the basket between earth and heaven. Now, I used to think that these women were probably wicked. They've got the wings of a stork. A stork is an unclean animal. So I thought, well, maybe this is Assyria and Babylon taking away the idolatry of the nations of the people. But I think that might not be right. These two women are doing God's work. And a stork was a migratory bird. It's a strong flyer. I think that might be the idea. It comes with the wind in its wings. It's flying strong, coming powerful. You're the wind beneath my wings. You keep me going. It comes with the wind in its wings. These two women pick up this basket. They lifted up the basket between earth and heaven. Now, verse 10. So I said to the angel who talked to me, where are they carrying the basket? They're carrying it somewhere. He said to me, to build a house for it in the land of Shinar. When it is ready, the basket will be set there on its base. Why do you build a house? Kind of a no-brainer, but why do you build a house? To live there. We're going to build a home for this wickedness. It doesn't belong among God's people. We're going to take it somewhere and give it a nice, we're going to give it a place to live where it'll feel at home. And that place is the land of Shinar. Shinar is mentioned 7 times in the Bible, and this is the last time it's mentioned. They're all Old Testament appearances. And does anybody know where Shinar is? It's Babylon. It's Babylon. Nimrod's kingdom began in Shinar, Genesis chapter 10, verse 10. Shinar is where the Tower of Babel was built, Genesis chapter 11, verse 2. Shinar is where the objects of the temple were carried, Daniel chapter 1, verse 2. That's the home of Babylon. And Babylon stands as that city which is opposed to God throughout Scripture. So we're going to take this wickedness from the city that belongs to God, and we're going to take it over to the city that's opposed to God, because that's where it belongs. These things are all opposed to God. Now, I think there's maybe kind of a neat parallel here. And this didn't originate with me, but I like it. Nebuchadnezzar came to Jerusalem, and he took those objects out of the temple. He took something that belonged in Jerusalem, in a house in Jerusalem, and where did he carry it? Yeah, to the house of his God. He took what belonged in a house in Jerusalem, and he carried it to his house in Babylon. But eventually, what did Cyrus do? Send it back to where it belongs. The nation of Israel has brought from Babylon to Jerusalem things that belong in Babylon. And so what? We're going to send it back. Send it back there where it belongs. Let that which is against God be with that which is against God. Now, was this ever literally fulfilled among the physical nation of Israel? No. We don't see a total purging there. I do think here we may be seeing a reference ultimately to the heavenly Jerusalem, the Israel of God, the church. Sin is constantly being removed from the church through repentance. It's being removed from the church by withdrawing from people. And ultimately, at the end of time, it's going to be completely removed from the church. And Jerusalem will be pure. And all that belongs in Babylon will be in the same place and together. So, it's neat how all these things go together. And we're ready for that final vision unless you've got some comments or questions. All right, the first vision had four what? 4 horses. We're now going to see 4 chariots. We began with observing the things in the God taking note of what's going on in the world. Now he's going to do something about it. Then I turned and raised my eyes and looked, and behold, 4 chariots were coming from between 2 mountains. And the mountains were mountains of bronze. With the first chariot were red horses. With the second chariot, black horses. With the third chariot, white horses. And with the fourth chariot, dappled horses, strong steeds. Okay. First of all, let's note some similarities and some differences. In Vision 1, we had the 4 horses. They were colorful, just like these are. The colors were different, but they were similar in that respect. They were in a valley. Remember that? They were down in the hollow. Here, these horses come out from between what? 2 mountains. So we kind of got the idea of a hollow there, perhaps, as well. And in both cases, the horses go out to patrol, to walk to and fro throughout the earth. Now, those are the similarities. There are some differences here. In Vision 1, the horses were mounted, and here, they're attached to chariots. Now, horses are objects of war under the Old Testament, but chariots are really objects of war. All right? So that, they remove any confusion about what these are about. In Vision 1, the horses were standing still. They'd already been out throughout the earth. Vision 8 now, they're still, and they're going to be going, out throughout the earth. In Vision 1, they were surveying the world. In Vision 8, they're going to judge the world. In Vision 1, they were aware of the earthly situation. Now God's going to take action, as I've said. He turned and raised his eyes, and he sees these four chariots. I think, again, here, four may just be a symbol of the earth, related to the earth here. Although, I'm going to share a possible explanation here. I don't want to get there too fast. I do think these four chariots, I think it's a neat idea, and it does seem to fit, that these four chariots may also coincide with those four kingdoms from Daniel 2. And I'll explain to you why I think that's a possibility when we get there. But chariots were almost always instruments of war. They were the storm troops in ancient warfare. Psalm 68, verse 17, God uses chariots. Psalm 68, 17, the chariots of God are 20,000, even thousands of thousands. The Lord is among them as in Sinai in the holy place. When Elijah was about to ascend into heaven, what happened? God brought a chariot. That chariot separated he and Elijah, Elisha, and Elijah went up into heaven in the whirlwind. But that chariot was doing God's work. Remember when Elisha was in Dothan in 2 Kings, and he and his servant there, the Syrians have got him surrounded, and his servant's saying, what are we going to do? And Elisha prays, 2 Kings 6:17. Elisha prayed and said, Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see. Then the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of what? Horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. God used these chariots to do his bidding, and they're going to do his bidding here. Now, they come from between two mountains, and mountains, again, are a symbol of what? Kingdoms, at least some of the time, if not always, they're symbols of kingdoms. Daniel 2:35, Daniel 2:44. But they're not just any mountains. They're mountains of what? Bronze. Okay. I'm sure some of you are already there. If you look at commentaries, you're going to see them sometimes saying, well, these mountains are the Mount of Olives and Mount Zion. These are two mountains in Jerusalem. The chariots are going out from Jerusalem, out from the presence of the Lord. And you think, well, maybe. But it says they're of bronze. And when I read bronze, what do you think of when you hear bronze? I think of Greece. Greece was the kingdom of bronze in Daniel 2. Over in Daniel 7, the fourth beast, which was Rome, had teeth of iron. That fits Daniel 2, but it had nails of bronze because Rome inculcated so much that was Grecian. So bronze is the color of Greece. So I see two mountains of bronze, and I can't help but think that this has some association. But it used to puzzle me. I mean, for example, one question that might arise is, well, if it's the kingdom of Greece, why do we have two of them and not just one? Well, let me pose that question to you. Why might we have two mountains of bronze rather than just one? Thinking of what would ultimately happen to the Greek Empire. Those of you who are familiar with that history. What's that? All right. Now, originally, how many prominent generals were there? That's right. The horn was broken in Daniel 8, and up from its presence came four more horns. And yet, ultimately, that really got boiled down to two. The Seleucid Empire and the Ptolemaic Empire. Antiochus Epiphanes, who I know some of you are aware of, was a Seleucid king, and Cleopatra might be the most famous member of the Ptolemaic kingdom. I'm going to attempt a map here. Here is Israel. I probably didn't make it high enough. Down here in Egypt is where the Ptolemies are. The Seleucids are way up here in Syria. Here's a mountain, and what's smack dab between them? Here's Jerusalem. And I do wonder if that might be the idea here. That they're coming out from between these two mountains, this area where God is now going to dwell when the temple's completed. God's going to be here. They're going to go out from the presence of the Lord. And so they're going out from between these two mountains of bronze. I just submit that for your consideration. Sometimes things can be neat and not true. And you wonder about that sometimes, Andrew. Israel? Yes, they were at one time. Interesting idea. I won't say no. I lean away from it, but I think that bronze is what I keep coming back to. And, you know, by the way, remember, and here's again, you can make too much of this maybe, but remember in Daniel 2, you've got the head of gold, and Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar, thou art this head of gold. The kingdom of Babylon was really embodied in Nebuchadnezzar. Once he died, the kingdom was gone within like 21 or 23 years. He was Babylon. Then you get the chest and arms of silver, which is what? Medo-Persia, two flowing into one. And then you get the bronze. It's the torso and thighs, he says. One kingdom eventually breaking up into two. Now, I might be reading too much into that, but I like that. And I think that might correspond to these two mountains of bronze. Now, let's get into verse 2 now. What time am I supposed to end? 7? Hey, we're making pretty good time. Okay. First chariot were red horses, Revelation chapter 6, verses 5 and 6. We saw the third seal. We saw red horses there. Revelation 6, verse 4. We saw the second seal, and the red there was a symbol of war and bloodshed. And I think that symbol works pretty well here. The second chariot had horses of what color? Black horses. Now, we didn't see this color in Vision 1, but we know what it symbolizes. Revelation chapter 6, beginning in verse 5, when he opened the third seal, I heard the living creature say, "Come and see." So I looked and behold, a black horse, and he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures say, "A quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine." Scales are what you use when food is scarce. Spending a denarius for food is an exorbitant price. Denarius is a day's wage. Paying a full day's wage for a quart of wheat says that food is extremely scarce, it's famine, we're measuring it out, we're paying a lot of money for it. So black is a symbol of famine, scarcity of food, and maybe the death that comes with that. All right, so we've got the red, war and bloodshed, black, famine, and death. The third chariot has white horses. White's a symbol of what? Victory. Revelation chapter 6, verse 2, the white horse, their rider went out conquering and to conquer. So that's clearly victory, it seems to me. And now he says the fourth horse, the fourth horses were dappled. Does anyone have a translation other than dappled? It's in verse 3 there. I don't know that it matters a whole lot. What is it? Bay? Okay, yeah, the King James has some different words here. The word dappled, as I understand it, means spotted, sprinkled with spots, especially white ones, according to Gesenius. And I thought about asking, does anyone here know a lot about horses?
Appaloosa?
I don't even know what that means, Steve. No, that's my problem, not yours. What's Appaloosa?
It's a horse that's gray and white with spots.
Okay. Well, that might be what we're looking at here. I'm not entirely sure. But something spotted, sprinkled with spots here, this might correspond to the pale horse in Revelation chapter 6, verse 8. I understand if you feel like that's a stretch, because I personally feel like it might be a little bit of a stretch too. But I guess I'm trying to make sense of it, and it could be the pale horse. The pale horse in Revelation 6, verse 8 was symbolic of death, and with it went God's four severe punishments. Revelation 6, verse 8, I looked and behold a pale horse, and the name of him who sat on it was Death, and Hades followed with him, and power was given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill with the sword, with hunger, with death, and the beasts of the earth. And death there, I think, is a symbol of pestilence, because in Ezekiel 14:21, we have those same four punishments mentioned. These are called God's four severe judgments. They all go together. When you go into war, you go with the sword, and people die by the sword. And because you send your young men off into war, they can't be out in the field, they're not there to provide for their family, and before you know it, food's been consumed, and there's no one to bring any more food home and to cultivate more food. So you get hunger. And then with hunger, people get weak, they get sick, and you get disease, and then with disease, people die, and here come the wild beasts wanting to eat the dead bodies. All these things go together. And it goes with the pale horse, and that might be the idea here. That would be consistent with the judgment. Somebody said that the spotted aspect might correspond to the blotchy appearance of the skin during starvation and pestilence, and that's an interesting thought. Okay. Oh. Okay. Thank you. That makes me feel good. Now notice, at the end of verse 3, my New King James, after it says dappled horses, has a dash, and it says strong steeds. The question comes up as whether or not the strong steeds refers to the dappled horses or whether it's to refer back to all the horses. If you're reading from Young's Literal Translation, the New American Standard, they just say strong dappled or strong grizzled horses. Those translations, which are very literal, have chosen to put the strong with the dappled horses, which is very interesting. However, if you're reading from the ESV or the NIV, those use the expressions all of them strong, which seem to take in perhaps all the horses, that strong is just a reference to all of them. I don't know which it is, but it does have some interesting implications here in a moment, which we'll get to. But you've got commentators and translators on both sides, so I don't know which is right, but it's something just to know and file away in the back of your mind. Zechariah does the same thing he's done before now, verse 4. I answered and said to the angel who talked with me, "What are these, my Lord?" And the angel answered and said to me, "These are four spirits of heaven who go out from their station before the Lord of all the earth." Does anyone have a translation that says different than spirits of heaven? Winds. It might be worth just pointing out, the word for spirit is also the word for wind in Hebrew. Just like in the Greek word is pneuma. We say pneuma, that's fine. Pneuma, and then I think the Hebrew word is ruach. R-U-W-A-C-H. These words can be translated either wind or spirit, and it really depends on the decision of the translator. And context has to determine that. I do wonder if winds might be a better translation here, and I'll explain to you why. In the Old Testament, God describes the four winds as a way of bringing judgment on another nation. In Jeremiah 49, verse 36, God brought the four winds against Elam. "Against Elam I will bring the four winds from the four corners of heaven, and scatter them toward all those winds." Now, the four winds there may have been a symbol of Nebuchadnezzar's multinational army, but it doesn't change the fact that four winds are brought and used as judgment. In Daniel 7, and I hope you'll bear with me here, but in Daniel 7, does anyone remember how the vision of the four beasts begins? What do those beasts come up out of? They come up out of the sea in Daniel 7, verse 2. And that verse reads, "Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea." Now, according to Revelation 17, water is a symbol of people. That makes sense. Nations come up out of people. But this water is not peaceful. It's being stirred up by the four winds. Most nations arise out of what kind of circumstance? Turmoil and war, isn't it? I mean, how did our own nation rise? War. Most nations, I think I can safely say, arise out of some kind of battle, out of some kind of war. So I wonder if the four winds there in Daniel 7:2 are, here is where nations are in battle and war. God's four winds are acting on men. And out of those kind of circumstances are coming the nations. In light of Daniel 7:2 and Jeremiah 49:36, I do wonder if these, instead of saying the four spirits, maybe the four winds, God's warlike agencies that he's using in the affairs of men. And now let me suggest to you what I'm thinking with respect to these kingdoms. I know this is a lot of preliminary work, but I think it might help us make sense of it once we get there. If we take the position that these four horses, these four chariots, correspond to the four kingdoms, well, let's just go ahead and write it up here so we can reference it. The first horses were red. This would be what kingdom? If we based it on Daniel 2 and Daniel 7. What's that first kingdom there? Babylon. All right. And I realize this might seem a little arbitrary at the moment, but once we get into the vision, I think it will seem less so. So the first horses are red. This might correspond to Babylon. The next group of horses was what color? Black. This would be Medo-Persia. Third group of horses was white. What kingdom would that be? Might be Greece. And then those last, those dappled ones. And I'm going to put strong here in parentheses because it may apply. It would be Rome. Okay. Now, again, it may seem arbitrary at the moment, but you see what you think once we get into interpreting the vision more carefully. With this in mind, let's start in verse 6. The one with the black horses is going to the north country, the white are going after them, and the dappled are going toward the south country. Now, what's the north country? Well, Israel's not going to be the north country. I mean, if they're going out from those two mountains, they're going out from Israel, they're going to the north country. What would that be? It's going to be Babylon. Babylon came from the north. Jeremiah 1:14, Jeremiah 4:6. Now, Babylon fell in 539 B.C., before this vision comes, quite some time before this vision comes, but the story with Babylon was not over. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown point out that 2 years after this vision that Zechariah is receiving, the Babylonians actually revolted, and Darius had to put down that revolt. And according to them, he brought on them what they call an awful desolation. Now, these are the black horses. And we do notice, by the way, what horses got skipped. He didn't even mention the red horses. Just like that thing doesn't want. The black horses are the ones who are sent. Now, if the blacks meet Persia, why would it be sent to Babylon? Well, Darius, the Persian king, is going to be the one to crush the Babylonian uprising, and it was Persia that crushed Babylon already in 539 B.C. So that's interesting. But who follows the black horses? The white horses, Greece. Now, why might Greece follow Medo-Persia up north? They're going to be the next kingdom. They're going to be the ones to destroy Medo-Persia. And white, it's a symbol of what again? Isn't that a perfect color for Greece? Alexander had incredible victories. Bang, 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 bang. Incredible, amazing victories. And he was able to cover a huge extent of the earth in something like 10 or 12 years. So I think that's interesting. That the black that Medo-Persia might be going up to finish the judgment on Babylon, that Greece is following them to finish the job on Medo-Persia in the future. And then interestingly, the dappled horses, what direction do they go? They go south. Now, what's south? Egypt, Edom, perhaps, which is an ancient enemy of God's people. Did Rome take Egypt? Yeah, they certainly did. And there's quite a story there. Cleopatra and Mark Antony and all that stuff. They did take Egypt. And I think this is further interesting. If the strong does apply to the dappled, isn't that just perfect? I mean, if it is, that's certainly right. Because what does the prophecy say about the fourth kingdom? Daniel 2:40, the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron. Daniel 7:7, the fourth beast was exceedingly strong. Rome had a strength that other nations before her had not had. And if it is, if these horses represent the kingdoms, this also helps me understand why Babylon's not sent anywhere. Because they're done for. Their work to bring judgment on Israel's over. So God doesn't have any reason to send them out. So I suggest that as a possibility, and you can make of it what you will. Any comments, Tom? Okay. Yeah. Good. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. That's true. Well, it's still an interesting statement, possibly. Okay, thanks for bringing that up. If it's not right, it's not right. I just pose it as a possibility. If this is all wrong, and these are just agencies of God that are not specific kingdoms, then the fact that red is not sent anywhere may indicate that whatever God had in mind for them has been done, or it may he's reserving it for future work. But that's very vague, and I can't offer you any explanation. So I guess that's maybe partly why I like this. This helps me understand why red's not mentioned. In verse 7, then the strong steeds went out, eager to go. Now, again, if this strong just means all the steeds, then this means they're all anxious to go out throughout all the earth, all the different places. But interestingly, the strong steeds went out, eager to go, that they might walk to and fro throughout the earth. Once Rome, if this is right, got done with Egypt, what did they do? They continued to go throughout the whole earth, conquering much of the world. And I think they even got beyond the Euphrates and discovered that was a little too much for them to hold on to. But they're eager to do God's work, it says. They were eager to go.